Good morning, good
Morning.
morning, and good morning to you too. This is Gloria J. Brown Marshall on Law of the Land, and I am pleased to be here this Women's Month to talk to you about literature, to talk with you about our growing responsibility to ourselves to stay healthy, of course, and we'll talk just only a little bit about that. But I want to talk more so, if I can, about these two guests who are coming. Brenda Green from the Center for Literature at Medgar Evers is going to talk about their conference. Larry Hamm is going to talk about his new book. But I first want to talk about the U.S. Supreme Court. For those of you who are having your children, grandchildren, or yourselves going out for spring break, leaving the country, I want to talk to you about a very important issue that's going on right now that's going to be argued before the U.S. Supreme Court. Indirectly, it's going to affect a lot of us. I know many people, young people, are going off to Mexico for spring break and other countries. Let me try to put this nicely. It's come to my attention through this case of Diaz versus United States. This case of Diaz versus United States is going to be argued next week. This is a case involving a drug mule. This is Women's History Month, so this is one of the downsides of women's relationship with men, especially men who are dealing drugs or men who are not respecting her in the way in which she needs to be respected, because we're ending up in situations in which women are used very often as drug mules. And I dislike the word mule, but it shows a beast of burden, which of course happens to us many times. In this case of Diaz versus United States, I will quickly say, because we have such a jam-packed show, that there is this situation in which a woman visits her boyfriend from California going into Mexico. While she's leaving, he says, "Drive my car back if you want, instead of taking the bus and other public transportation." She is with her daughter. And so they are driving back across the border from Mexico into the United States. And the border guards look in her car, ask her if she's carrying anything. She says no. And then they say, "Roll down the windows." It happens to be an old car with, manual roll down windows, not the push the button, but she tries to roll the window down. The border guard tries to roll the windows down in the back, and they don't roll down. Something is blocking the window from going down. They detain her, open up the side panels of the door, and find they are filled with drugs. She has been used as a blind mule, is what they call them. So these drug trafficking organizations, DTOs, are using people as blind mules. I want you to alert your brothers, sisters, cousins, friends, children, their friends. If they're going out of the country and coming back, especially if they're driving or if they're carrying packages back, they could be used as blind mules. And now, after she was convicted and sentenced to 7 years in prison, the issue is coming before the U.S. Supreme Court about the mens rea, the mind of the person being used, not the way you may think of that. The mens rea is, did they have the mindset that they knew that they were a drug trafficker, or were they actually a blind mule? Because if she didn't know she was trafficking in drugs, that's one thing. Then she is a victim. If she knew, mens rea, that she was committing a crime, then that means she's an accomplice and she deserves her sentence, so to speak. So this is the issue before the court, whether or not the expert witness in the case could say on the stand under oath that he knew, as a government worker, someone who has worked with drug cases for many years, he was an expert to know that it's very rare that a person would be used as a blind mule. Because, and this is what the expert testified, and this is in California, the Ninth Circuit, for those of you in law, that drug trafficking organizations would not trust such a prized possession as their drugs to a blind mule because they don't know if that person's going to go to some place and drive away with their drugs and never be seen again, because they have to remember to retrieve the drugs on the other side. They have people working on both sides of the border. So somebody's there with the driver's license number and everything to make sure that when they get to the other side, once they park that car, they can go into the car and get the drugs from it. Seize those drugs from the blind mule. And they're saying that most drug trafficking organizations would not trust their drugs to a blind mule. But since blind mule is a term and it's been used, that means there are people. The question becomes, did this expert witness actually have the knowledge base to say in the mind of Ms. Diaz that she was indeed a blind mule, unaware? One of the reasons why they like blind mules is because when they cross the border, they're not nervous. They don't know they're drug traffickers. So they can easily cross the border without suspicion, where people who are trafficking in drugs may look nervous, may give the whole scheme away. May be known to the law enforcement, may be in the system, but a blind mule is someone in the backpack, in a suitcase, in a package, in the car. They said that they've actually gone to the cars of people who are driving across the border and taped the drugs to the undercarriage of the car, put it sometimes in the trunk. How would they be able to get in the trunk? They've been said, and this is in the actual briefing of this case, that in certain instances, the drug trafficking organizations will have people who get the make and model of the car, find a way to get the key made for that car, get the key, open the trunk, put the drugs into the trunk, and then have those drugs trafficked over. Many of the cars, especially the older cars from the time period of the key, they like those kinds of cars because you can get a key for those cars made. Nowadays, you have to send off for the more modern cars, you have to send off for a key. But the older cars, remember the day they would have the locksmith come to your car and get the key made for it? Well, that's the kind of car they're looking for. The other thing that they're talking about is the fact that if they can find a way to get the drug to the other side, follow that person to the other side, as in the Diaz case, then they can retrieve the drugs once the car is parked. Maybe at school, and they like students, because if the students are going across the border in a car, they can just go across the border or have their colleagues, so to speak, across the border, see where the car is parked in the apartment complex or in the parking lot of the school, go into the car or under the carriage, get the drugs, and they're gone. So these are the types of people they're looking for. Students, they're looking for people unaware. But this is Women's History Month, and I want to focus on the women. The fact that they are being used as drug mules, predominantly women being used as drug mules, and in this particular case as a blind, and I say once again that phrase really gets me, blind drug mule by her boyfriend. This case is going to be argued next week. Of course, our U.S. Supreme Court cases are being recorded. You can listen to them. And if you're down in Washington, D.C., you can go into the courtroom, all of our courtrooms, unless they have state secrets or family court cases, they are open to the public under the Sixth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. That is our U.S. Supreme Court case today. Women, beware. Yes, we go through so much for so many, and especially for love. But we've got to protect ourselves. And that was her daughter, another generation of females now being traumatized by this incident. Take care of yourselves. We must take care of ourselves. We must take care of each other. Yes, we do. And we must, because we're worth it. Well, we're now going to go to our guest as we are going to a conference, and I'm excited about this conference and talking with the excellent, eminent, oh my goodness, in literature, oh my, Brenda Greene, Dr. Brenda Greene is with us today, and I'm just so excited to have you here to talk about this wonderful conference. Good morning.
Good morning, Professor Marshall. Thank you so much for having me. It's really,
Yes.
really exciting to give you to give me an opportunity to share this historic gathering that you will
And
also be part of.
yes, and it is historic. The names here are just absolutely amazing. And the fact that I'm going to be interviewing Percival Everett of Erasure, which is the novel that American Fiction is the movie based on, that Jeffrey Wright, all of that Oscar glitz that just happened. And I'm just absolutely just honored that you would have me be a part of this. But let's start one day at a time. This is a conference from March 20th to the 23rd at Medgar Evers College. Where do we go from here is part of the theme, but all that we carry. How did you come to that title?
Well, I was really motivated to come to that title. First of all, looking at what is happening in this country. And when we look at developing the theme of the conference, we have to take into account where we are in this country, looking at the politics, looking at media, looking at the whole banning of books, looking at the suppression of voting rights, the rise in anti-hate crimes, and rise in white supremacy. All of these things are going on, and our writers have always been the documentarians. They're the ones who do that deep thinking and lead us forward. Taya Miles wrote a book called All That She Carried, The Journey of Ashley Sack, a Black Family Keepsake, and it won a National Book Award. And Taya Miles is an historian at Harvard University. That book gave me the impetus. I said, that's a really good way of looking at chronicling where we've been and how are we going to solve this? What are some ways we can solve this? And The Journey of Ashley Sack really is the story of an enslaved woman. It's a narrative, but it's based on a true story of an enslaved woman in 1850 South Carolina who finds out that her daughter Ashley will be sold. And so she packs a cotton sack with keepsakes for her daughter. And decades later, in the early 1900s, the sack is found. So what Taya Miles does is to trace the journey of this sack. And she also chronicles the experiences endured by enslaved people from the 1850s through the early 1900s. So you have her take on the horrors of slavery, the Civil War, Reconstruction. And so we took that and said, okay, let's start with that. Let's look at what we have carried as a people, and how have we endured, how have we persisted despite what is going on around us. And it underscores the importance of tradition, of collective memory, and what is happening now and around the culture wars, and as I said, the voter suppression and rise in white supremacy and racism, and talks about the impact of we're looking at the impact of the social media and also the need for peace and emotional healing. That also has to be part of our conversation. So that was
Yeah.
the impetus behind that.
Oh, and once again, this is a conference March 20th to the 23rd. And I'll tell them now, we'll tell them again later how they can register for it. But how can they register for it? Let's make sure we get that
So
out
let's,
now.
yes, you can register for it by going to the Center for Black Literature website, www.centerforblackliterature.org. You will see a screen. You can click on register, www.centerforblackliterature.org/events. So you can register now. We encourage you to register now. Our opening night is free and for the public, we start on March the 20th, but we have also some pre-conference activities on March 19th. We really want you to be part of this gathering and to create some memories and to really support our writers and speakers and scholars. We have so many people who are coming out because they want to be at Medgar Evers College, because they're committed in doing the work that the Center for Black Literature has been doing for the last 22 years. and the work of the National Black Writers Conference, which began in 1986. So again, please register now. We want to make sure that when our writers come, you are there.
And let's just talk about a few things. Real Sisters, and that's an organization that has been focused on films by Black women or around issues involving Black women. That's one of the pre-conference events. And we also have, and I'm just looking on the website right now, you can just see all these amazing things, a music cafe, and the keynote, the opening day keynote with Michael Eric Dyson. That's going to take place in Farrah Jasmine Griffin. So Michael Eric Dyson is a dynamo right there. We know that he has, about 15 books out that he's written around a lot of issues.
At least. Yes.
And so that's part of the opening. But that opening is going to also involve the issues around environmental racism, social injustice, the attack on the Black bodies, domestic violence, terrorism. So what I think I want my listeners to know, when you hear about a writer, and they know that I'm a writer, they know I'm working on a book right now that's under deadline, and please prayerfully pray for me to get this book out in the next 2 weeks so that I can have my life back. But one of the things, writing is an isolated endeavor. I sit at my desk. I, you know, just try to think of each word. How can I convey my thoughts? But then to have a gathering of writers, this is what's so wonderful, because you can come out of your isolation and share all these thoughts. And so these social justice issues and other issues that are pertinent to our communities, whether or not it's nonfiction, which means it's based on truth, that as it is, or is fiction based on the world we want to build, those issues and concerns in our community will be brought together by you. That is just such an amazing, is it a responsibility that you are bringing together all these hundreds of people around the issues of our truth as well as our unrealized world that we're trying to build? How does that feel to know that you're the circus master here?
Thank you. I always, you know, an inspiration is the late John Oliver Killens, who, when he came to Megar Evers College as writer in residence, said he wanted to bring together Black writers every year to discuss the trends in Black writing. And our first theme of the conference, our theme for the 1986 conference, was the social responsibility of the Black writer. And I think Black writers still have a social responsibility, you know, and they have to do what Toni Morrison calls right from the Black gaze, to be political. They don't have a choice but to be political, but they could also be irrevocably beautiful at the same time. So they use their voices and the books that they create to get us to think more deeply about the issues that were facing us, and to get us to look at ways forward. What are some paths that we can have in order to heal and to address these issues? And this gathering is really important. We haven't done it in person since 2020, but there's something about bringing people together in a community and the energy that's created and the spirits that's created, and getting them to listen to writers who are not reading papers, but who are talking to them, and then to be able to have our attendees be in conversation with the writers, to raise questions, to give comments. That's really a very, very special and unique experience. I always like to quote Sonia Sanchez, who said, "This is a conference where writers who are coming, they check their egos at the door. So we're all together in this conversation, and we have to do that. That's what we have to make sure, that we are talking to each other and really fleshing out what we can do as a community and what our responsibility is." So I always say that I know John Oliver Killens is really smiling down, because he has given us a blueprint for doing what he started at Howard University and what we're continuing. And the writers are coming because they are committed to the mission of the center. And they want to come to Megar Evers College because of the symbolism at coming to a college that was named after the late civil rights leader who was tragically murdered, Medgar Evers. You know, so I think all of these issues that will be coming up. In fact, one of the things we're doing, we're going to have a voter registration table at the conference on Friday and Saturday. It's so critical that we exercise our right to vote. And so we want everyone who's not registered to vote, you'll have an opportunity to do that at the conference. This is all in the name of what we're doing around social justice and raising awareness and consciousness of the critical issues that are in our society, and not just looking at the news and the media, looking at how technology impacts what we do. Technology sometimes shapes what we do and gives us distorted pictures. It's important that we have narratives that our history is not distorted. That's why we have a panel on the power of historical narratives. So this is the place where you can really dig in and also see how you can have an impact and look and buy the books. You know, how we support Black writers is buying the books. How do we ensure that, you know, there's an attack on not only books, but there's an attack on Black studies in the schools? You know, our writers are being prevented from having their books published. You know, they have to show, there's some faculty who have to show their syllabi in some states to the state before they can decide what they're going to teach. We have to stop this, and it won't stop unless we take action, and we can do that through voting. We can do that by supporting these gatherings. We can do that by talking to each other. We can do that by buying the books of our writers who are raising these issues and who are sometimes have to walk around and have bodyguards because they're raising issues that are so critical and that people do not want to speak about.
Yes, and Farah Jasmine Griffin from Columbia University, African-American Studies Department, will be there. And I want people to know that Wednesday the 20th, I believe that is a program that is free. So I want you, my listeners, go to the Center for Black Literature. Center for Black Literature. Go put that into your search terms. Go to that page. Reserve your spot for that opening day. And you will be mesmerized, telling your friends, you've got to be here. This is the place. Remember, I'm in the middle of writing a book. I'm on deadline. I've turned down many speaking engagements for Women's History Month. I'm going to be there. And I'm going to be there for a day. I'm just one part of a packed day on Friday of the conference that starts in the early morning. My panel is in the late afternoon, early evening. And I'm just one of many. They're the names, just go on and on. I'm just amazed. So I want you right now to be part of the National Black Writers Conference. I want you to be part of the Center for Black Literature, part of our community. As was pointed out, across the country, Black writers, African American studies programs, we're under attack. And I want to go back to this thing about book banning. This is not new. Book bans have been in place since Ovid in antiquity. But what I'm saying right now, the pointed part of book banning is to stop Black people from learning, which is just what happened during slavery when we weren't allowed to read, or by pain of death if we were caught learning something. We had to have our own schools. We had to do all these things. The HBCUs, if you have your child in an HBCU and they are home for spring break, they need to be at this conference, the 20th through the 23rd. I'm saying that to my listeners, all of you who have anyone who's in college, a child in college, they need to be at this conference if they're home for spring break. It's at the Medgar Evers College, and it's the National Black Writers Conference. I want to go to something else that I think is important about this conference. The issues and the concerns for each panel, there are panels going on all day long. There'll be vendors there, and the vendors are fantastic. I always buy something wonderful from the vendors. But How did you come up with some of the titles? Tell us some of the panels, and we're down to our last moments, but tell us some of the panel topics so that they understand when they're coming, you're not just hearing the writers read from their books, which is fantastic, but you're also going to be hearing these panel discussions.
Right, and in fact, they're not going to be reading from their books. They're using their books as a point of departure. So we have technology, social media, and the fight for racial justice, which begins on Friday morning, and that's the title of a book by Mark Lamont Hill, who is one of our writers. We have we have Bettina Love, Wesley Lowry, Emily Rappaport, is moderated by Jelani Cobb. I will actually be in conversation on Thursday night with Taya Miles around the theme of the book and her work. The Healing Power of Literature is also one of the themes about how we look at how we can use literature to provide solace and to provide empathy and to look at how we fortify ourselves. Black writers' letters to America. Black writers given opportunity, if they're writing a letter to America, what are they going to focus on? So this is looking at letters that focus on what Toni Morrison calls the Black gaze. We have Pamela Newkirk, who did a book on diversity in the business world. She did Oda Benga, Tabiti Lewis, who's done Tony K. Bambara, Victoria Christopher Murray, and who's done a book on the personal librarian, a woman who passed working for J.P. Morgan. These are writers who are basing their work on experiences of Blacks throughout the America. What is the letter? What is the point? Power of Historical Narrative, Ayanna Mathis, A.J. Ferdell, and Mary Emmon Graham, who just finished a wonderful biography on Margaret Walker. And the biography is The House Where My Soul Lives, where she works for 10 years on telling Margaret Walker's story. And as we know, Margaret Walker, the poem For My People and the novel Jubilee. We have Black writers crossing boundaries and borders. We have Edgewise Dondekat, who's really chronicled a lot of what is going on in Haiti, but also focused on the family and relationships and the challenges that Black writers who are writing political stories and essays face. Kwame Dawes, a phenomenal poet who crosses both the continents of Africa, coming from Ghana and also from Jamaica. Patrick Enangu, who is, and I may be pronouncing his name wrong, but he tells the story of the Cameroon and what is going on, the political issues there. Stephanie Martelli, who's from Toronto, Canada, who's also an artist and also an essayist. Will be part of that conversation.
May I want to make sure I give myself a prop, and not for me. It's my panel at the end of the day on Friday is going to have Ta-Nehisi Coates' father, Paul Coates, who is a publisher of Black books for decades. Percival Everett, as I said, who wrote the book Erasure, that is the basis for the film American Fiction. You must see. And one of these days, I want to be able to talk with you about Erasure as well as American Fiction, Brenda. Peniel Joseph, Bernice McFadden. That's going to be on Friday at the end of the day after a full day. And there are Q&As. That's the other thing. You're not just sitting there as an audience member. There's going to be a Q&A interaction with the writers, with the themes of each of those panels that'll take place after each panel. So you will be involved. You won't just sit there and just take it in, which is a lot. I think it's great that you'll be able to have that because I'm always excited about that. But also each panel will have a Q&A. But there's one other part in which the Elder Writers Program, and let's, if we can sum up that. And once again, I'm talking with Dr. Brenda Green of Megger Evers College, who is an extraordinary writer in her own right, but she's also the leader of a conference that I've been a part of now, I would say, at least 10 to 15 years in small ways. I'm always begging her to be a part of it. And I'm, and I get to be a part of it again. But this is the Center for Black Literature's conference. This is the jewel in the crown of literature, Black literature events around the country, actually of literature events, because I go up to a lot of different literature events as a fiction as well as nonfiction writer. This is the jewel in the crown nationally. So you're right here. Don't take it for granted just because it's right here in your backyard. Go to Mega Evers in Brooklyn and be a part of this conference. But I want us to end with this program on elder writers. And that just seems like a remarkable program.
Yes, we started that in 2003, and it's unique in that the elders are writing their stories, writing about their experiences. They've written about what it was like to be under COVID, writing their reactions to the presidency of number 45, and looking at ways that they've used to heal, looking at the stories of the church. They have many different stories. We also published their book. That'll be on sale. Tales of Our Time will be available for sale. But that's always one of the highlights because they are going to read excerpts from what they've been writing, and that's on Thursday afternoon from 3:30 to 5 o'clock. So that we encourage you to come. People always really, really love that aspect of the conference.
Yes, I think it's fantastic. And once again, tell them where they can register for it. There are free events as well, vendors, books to be sold. It is the jewel in the crown, I tell you that, of literature. It's right here in our backyard at Mega Evers. It's the place to be. All the stars will be there.
Right. So you can, again, register by going to www.centerforblackliterature.org, www.centerforblackliterature.org. I also encourage you to come to our awards program, which is Saturday night at 7 o'clock. That is free and open to the public. Please come out and support our awardees. And I also, if you want to get a sense of what we've done, we just launched an exhibit that gives a digital exhibit. It's on our website, which chronicles what we've been doing since 1986 from the National Black Writers Conference and the Center for Black Literature. You can get a sense of what some of these conferences have looked like and who the people who've been there, just going to our website. So our website, you can go to register for the conference. Again, centerforblackliterature.org. You can get a sense of past conferences. You can see some YouTube videos of past conferences that we've had and speakers we've had. We are the one of two centers in the country focused on this. There is no other place like the Center for Black Literature. No other gathering like the National Black Writers Conference. We have over 60 writers, scholars, and poets coming together to be at Mega Evers College from March 19th through March 23rd.
So please come. In Brooklyn, come out. Thank you so much, Dr. Brenda Green. And I am excited, and I'm sure our listeners are, and will be there. And please, you know, writers will be signing their books. So this is the time to get that signed book from your favorite writer, because I am sure that favorite writer will be in the mix. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
This has been Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. Yes, this is a writing season, and our next person up is Larry Hamm, who has his memoir. Yes, Larry Hamm, the activist from Newark, New Jersey, all Newark in the house. Please stand for Larry Hamm when he comes to join us right after this musical break. This is a literary day, and we are making the best of it, using our minds and bodies. This struggle requires all of our talents. The struggle requires all of our talents. With me, someone I would say is a friend, someone who is so excellent in the area of activism that I am so proud that he wrote this book. It should be a primer for people. This should be a go-to book for anyone of any age interested in activism. And I, of course, am talking about my friend Lawrence Hamm. Larry, thank you so much for joining me.
Good morning, Gloria. thank you for having me on this morning. And it's good to hear your voice. But I hear it on a weekly basis. But it's good to hear you in person.
Lawrence Ham, A Life in the Struggle. This is fantastic. You and I had a chance to talk not too long ago when I was working on my book, The Activism Part, focused on Newark, New Jersey and the uprisings there. And I am looking forward to reading this. And just know that our interview, I even said, you've got to write a book. And
you did say that. Yes.
Yeah, this man has an extraordinary life. And so let's get into it, because we only have a short amount of time, and you have lived a life, my friend, and have a whole lot more living to do. Let's get into it. What really motivated you to write this book in the first place?
Well, what motivated me was a young woman named Annette Alston, and she has written this book with me. And Gloria, as you know, because you're an activist too, people don't, you know, they know you as a talk show host and an author and a playwright, poet, but you're also an activist, and you know there's a contradiction between being a person of action and a person of letters, so to speak. And for years, people have been saying, you know, I needed to write a book. I had been saying it to myself. I even tried a couple of times and stopped because of the requirements, you know, of running the People's Organization for Progress and being involved in other struggles against police brutality. But it was Annette Alston, who is an accomplished author, had published several books before she came to me, actually about 5 years ago, to propose that we work on this book together and we get it done. And it's really Annette Alston that I have to thank for getting it done. It's as much her book as it is mine. Also, I want to say happy Women's History Month. And when people read this book, they will also see the profound impact that women have had on my life and on struggles that I have been involved in, political struggles that I've been involved in over the course of the last 53 years.
And this is an autobiography of your life. First, I know that it chronicles a social justice activist for 50 years from your first protest in high school. And I remember when you talked about that first protest, and when you and I discussed that, that was in 1971. And just very quickly, tell us about it, because this is so interesting. And don't give everything away, because I want them to buy the book.
Okay. Right. Well, it's funny because this month is the anniversary. This is the 53rd anniversary of that walkout that I helped to organize. Well, I was the leader of the student government at Arch High School at the time. The students had many concerns about education, and all of that led to a walkout, a march, and a sit-in all in the same day. In Newark, New Jersey, and as a result of that cataclysmic event, I met Mayor Kenneth A. Gibson, the first black mayor of Newark, first black mayor in the 300-year history of Newark, and he eventually appointed me to the Newark Board of Education at the age of 17 on July 1st, 1971. I wasn't a student rep, wasn't an advisory board member. I was one of the nine voting members of the Newark Board of Education, and that made me the youngest school board member in the history of the nation, and I think I still hold that record because I wasn't even 18. I wasn't old enough to vote at the time I was appointed, and that set the vector of my life, and I've been moving in that direction, you know, the direction of struggle for the last 53 years.
Now, is it true that you got kicked out of eighth grade?
Yes, it is true. I got kicked out of eighth grade for an incident of vandalism. And when I look back on that event, and this was in 1967 that I got, it was in the early spring of 1967, I was kicked out of school, and eventually, you know, I was expelled, but eventually my mother brought me back and begged the principal to let me back into school. I had been involved in an act of vandalism. When I look back on that, it's a wonder I didn't end up in the police precinct and end up, you know, in Janesburg, which was a juvenile detention facility in New Jersey. And especially since, you know, that was the period, you know, that was the Black Power era, but Newark was still much under a kind of apartheid arrangement like many other cities, predominantly Black city, but under the rule of a white minority, and many of the, if not most of the institutions, you know, reflecting that same kind of arrangement. But, you know, through God's grace, I didn't go to jail, and I was able to get back in school and was able to graduate and went on to Arts High School, which I didn't want to go to, you know, but people kind of pushed me in that direction. I ended up going to Arts High School and started there in 1967. That, by the way, 1967 was the year of the Newark Rebellion uprising in Newark. We don't call it a riot. We call it a rebellion because it was a collective response to oppression. And that also had a profound impact on my life.
And that rebellion that took place there, and took place, rebellion such as that took place around the country in Detroit and in Compton and so many other places in New York City, how did it influence you? Because you ended up going to Princeton.
Yes. Well, first, on the rebellions, and I'm glad you mentioned the other places, one of the things, you know, because like each geographic area kind, you know, remembers its rebellion. Like Newark people remember the Newark Rebellion, and Harlem people remember the Harlem Uprising, on and on and on. Most people don't know that between 1960 and 1971, there were more than 1,000 urban uprisings in the United States. You know, it's hard to convey in words right now what a revolutionary period that was. You know, there was even a kind of phrase for it. People called it right around the cornerism, because we thought, you know, the revolution was literally right around the corner, you know. But even though the revolution per se did not happen, we had these tremendous uprisings all across the country. And that was, you know, during the civil rights era into the Black Power era. And the rebellion of 1967, you know, triggered a political movement in Newark, which led to the election of the first Black mayor in Newark. You know, I didn't come from a political family. I mean, I came from very much a working class family. My father's a truck driver. My mother was a seamstress, worked in the cleaners around the corner from where we lived on South 12th Street in the Central Ward of Newark. And, you know, I was a child, so I wasn't privy to all the adult discussions, but they had never had, like, a serious discussion with me about the issue of race until that night in July 1967 when the rebellion started, which we literally could watch from our second floor. We lived in a three-story, a three-family house in Newark, and from our porch on the second floor, we could literally see the rebellion unfolding in our neighborhood, you know. And so, you know, I had to ask my grandfather, because my father passed away when I was four, you know, what was going on? Why were people doing this? And that was the first discussion that night, sitting on the porch during the first night of the uprising that spread into our neighborhood, that my folks started talking to me about the issue of race, and probably those were the sparks of, you know, the beginning of some kind of transformation or some kind of development of political consciousness on my part.
Well, and I want to, because we only literally have a minute and a half, and I'm so sorry, because yes, it's like How can you sum up a life this way? And it's not a sum up because you have so many other things that you're still doing around protesting, around police brutality. You worked in the protests and were pivotal to the anti-apartheid movement to get Princeton to divest its stock holdings and companies doing business with the racist apartheid regime in South Africa. You were there with so many families who had been traumatized and devastated by police brutality, and continues to march to protest police brutality in Newark. You have led marches to Washington, D.C., and just the amazing issues you've been a part of as the youngest here, the longest standing there. And when you look at from the Million Man March to what you're doing even last week in another march against police brutality in Newark, that guiding light that you would say to our listeners that keeps you at it, because I think that's what happens. People get burnt out and say, enough is enough. I just give up. The other side is too big. Tell us, if you can, in our last moments, what keeps you at it, Larry?
Well, to be truthful, you know, I get discouraged too. You know, I get very discouraged sometimes, but I keep going because, you know, the struggle is part of my life. I mean, when I was in high school, I ran a 2 mile run in track, and I was a cross country runner. But anyone who runs a 2 mile, you know, is 8 laps, and you know, the race is not over until that last lap, the 8th lap. I'm on the last lap now. I really can't go back. I mean, I'm inspired by the people. When I see the people organizing, mobilizing, fighting against oppression, common people, working people, everyday people engaged in those kinds of struggles, that's what inspires me. That's what keeps me going, you know. And going to see this thing through to the end, Gloria.
To the end. But we're still in the middle. And how can How can they get the book, Larry Lawrence Ham? How can they get your book, Lawrence Ham, A Life in the Struggle? How can they get this book?
Right. Well, they could, if you go online, Africa World Press. It's published by Africa World Press. So if they go online for the book, Lawrence Ham, A Life in the Struggle, Africa World Press, they can find it online. Or, you know, they can call me directly at 973-801-0001, 973-801-0001, and we can try to get the book to them that way. But I want to thank the folks at Africa World Press for publishing this book. It was actually published, Gloria, believe it or not, in South Africa, you know, in the
And that's another story. We're going to have Larry Ham back on. And he's got to tell us more, because he is not just a treasure for Newark. He's a treasure for this country. The African-American people, thank you. Thank you, Larry Ham, for your service. Thank you
for your service.
This has been Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. And this is an honor to be able to bring these stories to you. Please support WBAI. Become a BAI buddy. Call 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. This is a treasure. Please respect it, support it, be there for it. What can I say except I'll see you. Thank you, Michael G. I'll see you all. Congratulations, women. Forgive yourself. Support yourselves. And I'll see you on the radio.